Our third speaker is a former economics editor of the FT and indeed former director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. 5 years ago, he was asked to make his forecasts and assessments in the Red Book rather than the Green Budget Book by taking the reins, or perhaps should be the leash, of the UK's independent fiscal watchdog. Ladies and gentlemen, the chairman of the Office of Budget Responsibility, Robert Choate.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure to be here. For those of you who don't know, the OBR was created, as Chris said, about 5 years ago in 2010, and the jobs that we've been given include producing the five-year ahead forecasts for the economy and the public finances that previously were produced by Chancellors of the Exchequer, using those to assess the government's progress against the fiscal targets that it set itself, and also to scrutinise the government's estimates of what individual tax and welfare spending policies will raise or cost. Now, in these areas, in terms of the work we do on the tax side, producing the forecast that we do and scrutinising the government policy, we're a relatively small organisation and we work closely with the experts in the individual areas of taxation at HMRC. And so, in a sense, the last 5 years has been an interesting institutional reform in having these sorts of issues, the outlook for tax revenues, the uncertainties around those, subject to a sort of process of internal challenge with, you know, different shoe on different feet, depending on whether it's a policy measure you're looking at or a forecast between us and HMRC. But I must admit, you know, having not quite known what to expect when we started, it seems to be working in many ways better than I anticipated it would do. Let me touch on two issues today. First of all, just to say a little bit about what is currently at stake for the government in terms of the uncertain outlook for tax receipts, and then to say a little bit about how we think about some of the different sorts of uncertainties around our own projections. And there's obviously an awful lot of overlap with the material that Paul has already taken you through. Go back to the budget forecast that we made in March. We were estimating that the public sector would raise in revenue about £680 billion last year. Now, of that, all but about 7 or 8% comes from taxes. There's other profits of public corporations, for example, but the vast bulk of that is from tax. And that's about, as Paul's chart was showing you, about 36 and a bit percent of national income, about £36,000 per family. Over the next 5 years, on the basis of current policy, as defined in the successive Red Books and the Autumn Statements, we're expecting those receipts to rise by about 25% in cash terms, so to about £850 billion. The economy is expected to grow a little less than that over that period, about 22%. So you're left with this small increase, what looks a relatively small increase in receipts as a share of national income, from about 36.3 to 37.4. And I think in thinking about the prospective path of receipts, in looking at how these things have evolved in the past, it's striking that you tell a very different story depending on whether you look at these things in cash numbers or whether you look at them as shares of national income. So many people, I think, would look at that chart Paul showed you of the variation in receipts over the course of the financial crisis and be astonished that there was such a small change there. Surely the whole reason we're having this huge fiscal consolidation is because all the tax receipts disappeared. So depending on how you actually paint that picture does give you a very different message. But in terms of this increase in revenue as a share of GDP that we're expecting over the next 5 years, the biggest contributor, not entirely surprisingly, is PAYE income tax. And that largely reflects a process called fiscal drag, in which the hoped return to relatively robust growth in real earnings would be expected to pull more income into higher tax brackets and therefore, in a sense, raise the average tax rate across the economy as a whole. National insurance contributions, self-assessment income tax, stamp duty all also contribute to this expected rise in receipts, and in all of those cases, that's partly, largely in many of them, as a result of policy measures, as Paul described. Those are offset by falls in receipts as a share of GDP from some other taxes. On the excise duty side, you have falls due to falling consumption of alcohol, falling consumption of tobacco, rising fuel efficiency, which Paul mentioned on fuel duty, and corporation tax dropping in part because of cuts in the tax rate, in part because of higher investment and greater use of capital allowances and policy changes as well. Now, as Paul said, the overall increase in that ratio of receipts to national income is by no means enormous. It's not going to move us dramatically up or down in the international league tables, and it would remain within this relatively narrow band in which receipts have fluctuated. I think you could take it even further back than Paul did to pretty much the early 1990s. But nonetheless, this modest rise in receipts as a share of GDP is material to the government's current plans to get rid of the remaining budget deficit it has, which is about £74 billion last year, and to get to a modest surplus of about £10 billion by the end of the current parliament and into the next. And if you look at that overall swing from remaining deficit into surplus, the government's looking for higher receipts, higher tax receipts, to deliver about a quarter of that. Welfare cuts contribute slightly more, and a larger contribution still from cuts in public services spending, but the receipts are not unimportant. The government's main fiscal objective is to get to a budget balance by 2019-20, and it's aiming to do that at the moment with about £10 billion to spare. That £10 billion surplus is about 0.5% of national income when you get to that horizon, and the past performance of independent forecasts of tax revenues, both ours and the Treasury's before that, suggests that there's about a 35% chance that receipts on their own will be 0.5% of GDP or more lower than that, and that therefore for that reason alone the fiscal target would be missed. The probability of the target being missed for other forecasting reasons, for example on the spending side, would take that overall proportion up to about 45%. So to the extent that the government cares about its targets, the uncertainty that lies around our or anybody else's projections for tax revenue is a real concern. So what are the risks and uncertainties around the central forecast, around our central forecast, or indeed about any central forecast? As Paul mentioned towards the end of his talk, the largest risk in a sense, and in particular obviously if you're looking at tax receipts in cash terms rather than as a share of GDP, the biggest risk is that the economy doesn't grow as quickly as we expect it to. The smaller the economy, the less there is to tax and the less revenue you get for given rates. That sounds relatively straightforward. Of course, it's a bit more complicated than that. The first thing to bear in mind is that when most people talk or write in the newspapers about economic growth, they're talking about growth in real GDP, which is what the statisticians measure as the change in the volume of goods and services, the physical, not entirely physical, but basically the amount of stuff that you're generating in the economy. And that makes sense if you're interested in how movements in the economy affect living standards, for example. But when you're forecasting receipts, you are, in a sense, much more interested in the cash or nominal size of the economy and in the relative strength of different types of income and spending that go together to make up national income or GDP. Taxes are typically levied on the cash rather than the real value of different types of income, spending or transactions, and the tax rates can vary widely between them. So as a result, for example, the exchequer suffers much more when wages or consumer spending are £1 weaker than they expected than when profits, business investment or the trade balance are £1 weaker than expected. And you can see those two factors, the importance of the nominal numbers and the importance of composition, at play in the wake of the financial crisis. One reason why the cash value of tax receipts fell so far below expectations doesn't show up in that chart of tax as a share of GDP, but if we drew it in cash terms, it would be a big decline relative to pre-crisis expectations, is that the cash size of the economy shrank during the course of the recession as well as the real value. And that's very unusual even in a recession. Normally you see the real size of the economy shrink, but the cash size of the economy is still increasing. Notable feature of the recent recession wasn't the depth of the downturn, but the very weak recovery that followed it. But then when that weakness became apparent between 2010 and 2012, tax receipts didn't actually disappoint as much as you might have expected, and that was down to composition. The weakness was concentrated in profits and business investment rather than in labour income and in consumer spending. In other words, in the more lightly taxed bits of the GDP than in the more heavily taxed bits. There are other economic risks around the outlook for tax receipts beyond simply the high-level strength and composition of national income. One of the most important of those in recent years, and I think it's perhaps the single biggest uncertainty still looking forward, has been the behaviour of the labour market, and in particular the so-called productivity puzzle. That is essentially that output per hour worked in the economy has been growing much less strongly, not just in the UK but elsewhere, than you would expect. And essentially employment has been doing very well even though GDP growth has been pretty weak. As a result, for a given increase in total wages and salaries, more of it than we and most forecasters have expected has come from employment growing and less of it from people's earnings growing more rapidly. And that disappointment in the strength of earnings growth mirrors the weakness of productivity. Now, that's bad news for receipts. Real earnings growth pulls people into higher tax brackets, while if you have a big increase in employment, an awful lot of the newly employed people aren't earning enough to pay any or much income tax. As Paul mentioned, distributional factors can also determine the strength of tax receipts, and not just the distribution of wages and other forms of income. So stamp duty would be a good example. If you based a forecast for stamp duty purely on movements in the average house price and the level of transactions across the country, you can very easily, and we have had those forecasts blown off course, if there are very different trends going on at the top end of the market, obviously mostly in London. So the number of housing transactions above £2 million was about 9% lower in the first 10 months of the last fiscal year that's just ended than in the equivalent period of 2014. That represents only about 390 transactions, but a loss of around £150 million worth of revenue. So small numbers can drive big numbers. You can have risks to your receipts forecast even if you manage to predict the headline tax base correctly. Again, Paul highlighted the taxes you get, or tax revenue you get from banks, corporation tax. Now, the outlook for the amount of tax you get from corporation tax from banks does not depend just on the outlook for the gross profits, future gross profits, but also on the pattern of past losses in the industry. So how long is it going to be before some big banks are in a position to pay tax again? Now that, as a watchdog, is very hard for us to interrogate systematically because, absolutely rightly, we don't have access to confidential information on individual taxpayers, and it matters quite a lot there because a relatively small number of taxpayers constitute a large part of the industry. Similar problem does arise with North Sea oil receipts, where changes in field ownership can matter quite a bit. As Paul's chart highlights, and if you take it back even further and compare outturns with forecasts, it's notable that the North Sea has been probably the single most volatile source of receipts over the last decade or decade and a half, about five times as variable as income tax in the annual change from one year to the next, seven times more volatile than VAT, and that's a reflection of the large number of volatile economic and non-economic determinants that go into that forecasts. Now, if you look at the forecast we produce at the time of the budget for revenue and for other public finance forecasts, it's important to remember that it's not our unconditional forecast of the most likely outcome. We have been asked by Parliament to produce a forecast of what is the most likely outcome under current government policy, and a lot of people will have different forecasts because they think policy is going to change, and they'll take that into account into their forecasts. Paul again highlighted a couple of ways in which it's important to bear this in mind interpreting what we do. The one point is that, as he mentioned, that we don't include things like manifesto promises to get the personal allowance to a particular level. We wait until that is clearly defined, and in particular the timing of these sort of measures is defined by having them as a legislated measure, an announced measure in the Red Book. And as Paul mentioned, in other cases, we are constrained to accept the government's definition of current policy, even though history suggests that they're going to change it. And as he says, the obvious example is fuel duty, where every time we do a forecast, we go to the Treasury and say, do you really wish us to assume that the underlying policy is to increase this in line with inflation? And we always make sure that somewhere it's written down that, yes, the Treasury has specified that it is. And then more often than not, of course, it changes. So again, it's the difference in the job. We are tasked with judging what the impact will be of what the government states as current policy. It's not our job to judge whether they mean it or not. For the tax policies that the measures that the government does announce, a relatively recent innovation we've introduced is that we are explicit about the uncertainty that we think lies around the government's estimate of the cost or revenue implications that an individual measure will have, even if we only do that quantitatively. A couple of years ago, we stole from the Australian Parliamentary Budget Office an idea which is to give each measure that is announced in a budget or an autumn statement a subjective uncertainty rating. And we base that on three factors that we're all always concerned about when we're presented with a measure and a nice long paper explaining what the cost or revenue implications are likely to be. First, the quality of the data that underpin it. Second, the complexity of the modelling required. Do you basically just need to multiply one number by another, or are there seven successive assumptions you have to make in order to get yourself to the right answer? And the likelihood of a significant behavioural response. Perhaps not surprisingly, budget giveaways tend to be relatively certain in their revenue impact compared to the measures that pay for them, notably anti-avoidance measures. Another thing we're trying to do to encourage more transparency and to improve future forecasting is to try to encourage more ex post evaluation of past measures, and we've done that looking in particular at some of the anti-avoidance measures. Clearly, we'd love to do a lot more of this, but we're conscious HMRC's analytical resources upon which we have to draw here. There's obviously always demands because new measures are being worked up, and you'd love to do lots more of that. But there's never all that you'd like to do, but I think we have a shared belief that doing work in that area can contribute to the quality of future costings. I think finally, let me mention something which we were just discussing on the way up, which is, I think, a potentially interesting area of uncertainty around future tax projections, which is how far we end up going with devolution. Under the Smith agreement, Scotland is going to have a greater degree of control over taxation. We have Northern Ireland setting its own corporation tax rate from 2018. And I think a very interesting question in terms of how easy the job is of producing forecasts is how much countries, nations to whom tax powers have been devolved choose to use those powers. Are we going to be in a world in which relatively simple things or relatively similarly defined things are going to be taxed at different rates within the UK? And you don't need to be a genius to see that that can present some potentially interesting behavioural consequences as taxpayers adjust to that in making business and consumer decisions. And I think it's just at the moment it's an unknown. There are those powers there. Scotland has had the ability to change its income tax rate for quite some time and hasn't used it yet. Obviously, there's been a reform there which has been followed by the UK government in terms of stamp duty reform, but I think an uncertainty around this whole area of tax forecasting is how much devolution is going to present us with new and interesting challenges. So let me leave it there.